read another little extract from a ghost story that I've written set in the Irish family. And it's about three children who are the last in a valley, the last living in the valley, and the dogs are starving, and the dogs have amassed around the little cottage where they are, and they've got into the cottage, into the living room, and the children have gone to the kitchen, and they've gone to the back room now, and they're in the little, small little back room where their grandmother died a few weeks before. The dogs are where you'll see. Tig sits trembling. Three characters, Tig, the little boy, Ellie, and Deirdre. Tig sits trembling on the side of the bed, trying to light the candle, but his hands are shaking so violently he can't do it. Ellie reaches over and steadies his hand, and together they light the candle their grandmother used each night when saying her prayers. It has not been lit since the night of her death. Neither Ellie nor Deirdre have entered the little room since she passed away. Tig sometimes woke in the night and went into the room. The night before last, Deirdre, awakened by a noise, went down and saw him in the room. Tig places the candle on the chair. Flame flickers and almost dies in the draft coming through the broken window into the other room. He cups his hands around it until it starts to grow, and for a moment its reflection flickers back from the pane, as if somewhere out there in the darkness there is another light burning too. Ellie notices a shadowy form moving outside the window and hurries over to draw the curtain. Deirdre sees the shadow too and gasps. All three children stare at the window now and see paws flattening against the pane, and then suddenly the wild head and gaping mouth of the dog, his eyes glittering in the reflective candlelight. Ellie pulls the curtain across, but they still hear the thump of his paws and snap against the pane. Three children clutching each other's hands stare at the wooden crucifix lit by the candle on the chair up by the bed. With trembling fingers, Tig opens the box, takes out one of the bones, closes his eyes and whispers a quick prayer, then waits for whatever is about to happen. The snarling and barking increases as the kitchen door gives way inch by inch. Children's lips move quicker and quicker in desperate, feverish prayer. At least, Ellie is thinking, they will die in their own home on the same bed as their grandmother. The legs of the chair holding the kitchen door screech across the stone floor, then stop. Some unevenness in the stone floor is preventing it moving any further. Despite the continuous onslaught of the dogs, they cannot move it anymore. And so the noise of the dog stops. Children listen intently, no barking or sniffing at the door, not even the soft thump of the dog's paws against the window and the rattling of the pane. It seems that the dogs have given up, that the danger has passed, that God at last has answered their prayers, but then there is a huge crash. The little bedroom window explodes inwards, and the dog who was outside drags himself in. The children, their pale faces glowing eerily in the candlelight, look at him in terror as he barks savagely at them, eyes mad with hunger, his coat straining with his own blood, jaws gnashing, he leaps through the air. In his onrush, he knocks the chair over. The candle topples, spilling hot wax onto Ellie's hand. She gasps and pulls it back. There is a rattle as the tin with the rest of the bones and the crucifix fall from the chair onto the floor. Total blackness fills the room. The dog is on the bed, which the children have abandoned in alarm. Tig is on his hands and knees on the floor, feeling about in the dark for the crucifix and the bones. He finds the crucifix and grasps it tightly, desperately. He feels hair brushing against him, the dog panting in his face. He hears another tug outside the broken window about to get in, then Ellie is snatching him and Deirdre and pressing them into the corner between the wardrobe and the wall, protecting them with her own body. shock now. His mind turns off. And he's seeing again his grandmother's kind old face. That last moment when she looks straight into his eyes before death took her. And it gets worse.
Thank you. Those of you who've been following Fiona Gale's tribulations over the last while might be interested in this. It's called Et Tu Brutum. The poor endure more savage cuts, while bankers go scot-free. We're gnawed, bludgeoned, battered to improve our GDP. You'd think that Fine Gael would now have found their finest hour to oust the present government and finally take power. But the full frontal lobotomy they performed upon themselves means promising careers are now wilting on the shelves. His own front bench saw Enda as inept, lightweight, and mild. The Gang of Nine were happy to treat him like a child. If Oxbridge tutored Bruton were to ask him to resign, the whole putsch could be dignified and save a lot of time. But Mayo men are tough as nails. The rebels got it wrong. Enda had their measure. He'd been ready all along. He'd fluffed his lines on water tax. He'd wobbled on Sinn Féin. And when George Lee deserted him, he really felt the pain. But Kenny'd been in politics for 35 long years. He'd watched five heaves on Hawley and faced up to his fears. So when the young Turks gathered, flashing golden credit cards, they sipped 20 cappuccinos with their sights on top awards. These were the rebels from the Pale, Clongos against the Tech. But the lads who munched ham sandwiches decided, what the heck? We'll always have our dinner in the middle of the day. Shout, up Mayo, and make damn sure that Enda has his say. Their chief may have to punch and crunch for Taoiseach in the end. Since Eamon Gilmore's joined the lists, preparing to contend.
Our next reader is our Flavors Challenge winner, John Bracken.
Thank you, Stephen. This is a piece called The Reporter's Story. A reporter had to write a story for his weekly column in the local. So he sought out somebody of interest who would be descriptive, clear, and vocal. Various people were suggested to him whose lives may be of interest. So he considered each fine suggestion in order to select the one that was best. Some suggested local sports stars who could utterly expertly wield, or the county champion runner who had won the famous Shield. Somebody mentioned that a good story, which would interest quite a few, could be written about a rich farmer as to how his wealth just grew and grew. So the reporter called on the farmer one night to learn how his financial health had increased to such proportions that made him man of wealth. It's a long story, says the farmer, So while I'm telling it, we just might. Save on the cost of the candle, and he blew out their only light. The reporter said to the farmer, "You need not go on, that's grand. As to how you have been so successful, I think I now understand."
Science myself, and I suppose one of the things that interests me, I'm interested in poetry and science, and sometimes I think that science and technology are reflected a lot in poems, whereas like people who like art, science and poetry are reflected in art. Science is reflected in art a lot more, I would say. Science tends to reflect in poetry. So this is just a poem, just with it doesn't really deal with the whole thing, but it's just got some words from science and technology. So I think words and technology can sometimes. So it's just that a little thing I wrote, and it's called "Scan from the Xerox Work Center." "Please leave me out, Dad. Planted here on your server. Seed of a thousand suns. Scan from the Xerox Work Center. Meaningful only to you. How many languages can I learn? Planted here on your server. Please leave me out, Dad. Jam and duplex pass, out of paper."
My next reader, whose first collection of poetry was launched here just a couple of weeks ago, Continued Errors. And I presume there's some here for sale, but if there isn't,
there is.
We still have the writer herself, Patricia Walker.
Thank you, Steve. Probably here for sale if you want them, if you want them to come up to me afterwards. Right, this one, these two aren't from the section. What I'm saying? It will be from future publication. "Madrigal. I hesitate to call it love when I first wheeled my eyes on you. You were there, sitting on the steps, and whatever you were doing pulled me further near them. Something to desire to have long washed ashore, sad and muddy, arriving from blankets of a perfect life. Whatever you were doing, it pulled and gathered me into an out of a secret distress. If we were meant to be together, wouldn't it have happened by now? Not yet, I only met you once, and now I don't even know what you look like. But there was a chemistry that arose beyond wishful thinking, and set the scene, I believe, for definitive times ahead, slowly occurring as they may be. But to think there is another way, I got another glimpse of your heart, knowing and sincere, something not to take a chance with. You lied about Celtic Civ, you're not even doing the subject. For the moment, I will forgive you of this change of sight." And this one is called "Never Forgive Me." "Never forgive me, I'm still so alone, and nothing's arising from my working vein regardless. Unchained, unindependent, and overstrained. I know not my own mind, it's all disjointed. There are many versions hypothesized, each giving a right answer. How do you know me? How can you understand this happy disposition that goes to nature? I don't drink anymore, and vow never to smoke. Oh, sighs, there's danger, so gracious, so cold. Holy open, doors open, and paying for drinks that are all on the table. I do not wish in any big way that you finally crawl away, and back to one you call a poison dish. Let your Christianized spirit lay the table. No offense to you and yours, but let it assist. One here is poison jealous, and mind, how you look after her won't twist the sweetness. She's off, you've done it. No need to remind any one of you how firm and safe she is. If her heart is acting up in a way, avoid her. K get within the limits of law and spirit, man of God, and persuader.
Say hello and goodbye to our next reader as she, I believe, is leaving for Germany very, very soon. So hello and goodbye to Edda.
Yeah, I've been appearing here for the last 11 months, so I'm leaving next week. This is simply called home. I worked the plane the years gone, and what a year it was indeed. It's time to go now, to move on. But going is no easy feat. It's strange, I think, as I go on, the loss I feel going away, that even though I'm heading home, it doesn't really feel that way.
Thanks, and good luck with wherever you're going, or whatever you're doing. All the best. We have Michael Pample. Michael.
Particularly for our guest here, Quincy, this is about hair coursing. Do you know what hair coursing is?
This is actually the short version. Believe it or not.
Hair coursing is when so-called civilized people in an enclosed area leave a little furry animal up the field and send two greyhounds after to kill it. They say it's not to kill it, but really. And the leveret is a baby hare. So the poem is The Leveret's Last Night. Your first day became your last night. Hush now. The night creatures will hear your mewling carry downwind, reverberating off the hardened earth beneath your cold form, amongst frost-stiffened grasses, where you wait for your mother's tawny warmth and the blood-hot milk from her teats to swill round your day-old toothless gums. The creeping cold is on you now, and daybreak will see you dead from starvation or hypothermia or both, or a tasty morsel for a wandering fox whose radar ears will fasten on your waning death cries. The suck your growling gut takes for was spume in the wind, or paled the crimson mist from your mother's torn belly, shredded by the savage teeth of a carefully thatched pair of half-starved hounds, who pissed themselves with the excitement of the kill, that heated the loins of the handlers to near sporting point too, as they debated with fierce intensity, determined that justice should be done. Which hound called your mother to turn first, as turn in terror she did, into the closing jaws of the losing dog, who thought he was the winner, and celebrated in style by seizing between yellow teeth her frantic head, while the loser, who really was the winner, held her rear left thigh as they tore her panting body asunder, her fluids flying in the winter wind. First kill today, tutted the slipper. Always reminds me of a baby crying, replied the judge, turning the card, wondering if there was time for a quick one before the next race.
Hands up those wanting to end the bird's work. I'm sure it's all over.
It's illegal.
That's complicated. Next up is Raymond Desmond with her question. Raymond. Is she here? Raymond.
Uncertain world, is there anything I can be sure of? In nature, maybe it's true, but when I look at me, look at you. I feel unsure of what could be said, what could happen. Things we think are right no longer make sense. Things we know are wrong suddenly are real. Is there a reason for the bad that I see? Is it God? Is it me? Does there have to be blame? Do I have to know? Is uncertainty the only safe place to go? Am I to take a leap of faith, to believe, to trust? I know that I should, I know that I want to, but the niggling voice at the back of my head, fearful, questioning, full of mind. Let go, I hear myself say, let go and jump. There is no fall, only flight, only joy. Let go, my love, let go.